Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Because it's time. It's time for reparations.
LGBTIQ rights are black rights. We have always been here. Black queers, we will always be here.
It's like, it's a form of cultural imperialism.
The only thing I have in common with this character is that she's black. This does not look like me or sound like me.
I'm Gary Foley.
I'm Francesca Ramsey.
This is Amir Rahman.
And you're listening to The Race Card.
Welcome to The Race Card. I'm your host, Amina Ziyard. And joining me in studio, we've got Ahmed Yusuf.
Hey.
And our guest host, Magan Magan.
Hello, hello.
And so before we begin, we'd like to do an acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge the Kulin people as the owners of the land on which we meet, and we pay respects to their elders, past, present, and future. This land was never ceded, and the processes of colonization, occupation, incarceration, and genocide that began over two centuries ago continue to this day. You're listening to our one-hour show where we chat politics, current affairs, and pop culture with a little bit of a twist. And joining us in studio is Sukhjit.
Hello.
And today, we look at the new indigenous superhero that's making waves, how activists and doctors protested the release of baby Asha, the indigenous politician not allowed to speak her language in parliament, and our feature discussion is on the accessibility and inaccessibility of anti-racist education and activism.
This week, we've got Sukhjit Kaur Khalsa, poet and, you know, taking Australian Idol, no, not Australian Idol, Australia's Got Talent. Australia's Got Talent by storm. Apologies, Sukhjit. But yeah, you are taking Australia's Got Talent by storm, and actually Australia by storm with that viral poetry piece.
So I just wanted to interject and say, I actually think Sukhjit could take on Australian Idol. It's not beyond you.
Oh, hey. Have you heard my singing?
Can you sing?
Yeah, I have.
No, I cannot sing. Hey,
I've heard you. You're all right.
Thank you. I just need some lessons.
How scary it must have been to actually go on Australia's Got Talent and do that in front of like millions of people. Like that's legitimately who you were performing towards. Because Australia's Got Talent, I'm pretty sure, gets like at the very least a million viewers or the like. And how big of a deal was that? How do you feel?
I think that I didn't tackle it as a... I didn't really fathom how many people I would be reaching. Because I didn't really understand what Prime TV actually meant until it went viral and people down the street actually started recognising me. But when I was performing, it was just... performing for any audience, just like going to Voices in the Attic or just like going to the State Library, and it didn't feel any different. But I think the after effects, since it had been pre-recorded a couple of months before, only when it got aired did I feel the effect. And I was like, oh my goodness, it isn't just Indians worldwide that were like, oh my goodness, and all the Indian newspapers are getting onto it. It's actually turned into like random people messaging my family members and distant family members from like Canada and Malaysia and like all just random parts in the Middle East, and just like going, hey, have you heard of this girl? And they're like, oh, that's my niece. Oh, that's my auntie. Oh, that's my... And it's just like, what? Like, I did not understand what viral meant until this week, to be honest.
Because I remember looking at your Facebook page, and you had like a paltry 24 likes. And I just looked this morning, and you got 6,300 and something. And like, I don't know what you did. You can maybe pass on that information to us. We've got like 500 and something people liking us on Facebook. By the way, if you're listening to the podcast, you should like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/RaceGuardShow. Yep. That's the plug done. But yeah, like how, because like that must have like changed a lot of, I guess, your everyday life. Because I remember you were saying just before we started recording, you went and had dinner with a friend and a famous friend, and they didn't get recognized and you did.
Yeah, that was so weird. Walking into any Indian, first I thought it was just Indian restaurants, but the restaurant I was talking about was actually an Ethiopian restaurant, and it was a night after the episode had aired. And this this restaurant owner actually rung up his kids and was like, "Oh my God, Sukhjit's here, Sukhjit's here." And I'm like, "What?" And people come up to you and they actually go, "Hey, you Sukhjit." And you just hear whispering going, "Sukhjit, Sukhjit, Sukhjit, Sukhjit." And you're just like, "Oh my God, like, wow."
So my question is, was there ever a moment of self-doubt? Did you ever question yourself going on Australia's Got Talent? Was this something that was on your mind to try out for a few years? I mean, what's this backstory?
It's funny because I feel like, of course, there was self-doubt. I'm going to answer that question in two parts. First thing, definitely self-doubt. I was so scared of the whole of Australia hating me because the first question you asked Ahmed was about, you know, is it nerve-wracking that you're going to be speaking about such a touchy topic on TV where it's not commonly seen in that way, and especially spoken word. I was scared that I had to represent not only spoken word, I had to represent the Sikh community. I had to represent Indians. It was just a lot of representation, and that's a lot of pressure to hold. So yeah, I had a lot of doubt. I was scared that I wouldn't even get through the first round, and the fact that I have is phenomenal, and I didn't expect it at all. But the first question you were asking about was what did you say before? You said self-doubt and okay. I forgot. I forgot it now. I forgot the first question. You said something else. Do you remember?
I guess it was just like...
Oh. Sorry, I think I remember. It was a backstory.
Backstory.
I mean, was this something you were planning? Was this something you were planning to get onto, or you just randomly on a whim maybe just decided to go
Absolutely.
For it?
Absolutely. Because I moved to Melbourne about 11 months ago, and I went back to Perth, I think it was around May or June last year, and I got an email. I'm not sure how, but I used to be part of an acting agency, so I think they were just sending out random casting calls. So I got an email saying auditions for Australia's Got Talent, and I remember watching that show as a kid. And, you know, I used to get caught up and swept away by the sob stories and the emotions, and I would watch them on YouTube and little clips all around the world because they've all got talents in every country. But I never could have picture my face on there. And now that it's happened, I'm like, wow, that just shows there is access to a lot of people. And, you know, we assume that it's a lot of tokenism when it comes to being of a minority in Australia from a different and cultural background. But I think I wanted to prove to myself, because as a kid, I never saw young Sikh girls on TV, on Australian TV. And I said, you know what? If no one else is going to do it, why am I waiting around? I'm not going to wait around till the next generation. We need to start doing it now, because I do not want to bring up daughters in a society that doesn't encourage us to, you know, pursue our passions and actually not, you know, live in this tokenist side character. I'm sick of being a side Indian character. I don't want that anymore. So I thought, you know what? What better way is it to go on national TV, talk about an issue that I'm really passionate about? And I'm just sick. And I'm also, you know, all these conversations we have, which I'm sure we'll be having today as well, about racial discrimination in Australia. It's interesting how they tackle it, or how we tackle it as a nation. I think we're going through an identity crisis, to be honest, as Australians. When, you know, you walk down the street and you ask someone, what makes you Australian? People have no response. Is it, you know, my birth that makes me Australian? Is it my accent? Is it? So I think it's really important to start asking these questions, because it's a really good time for that.
Were you kind of like afraid beforehand? Because you're going to be doing a piece, and have you been surprised by how it's been received? Because you've basically been the poster child for spoken word, the Sikh community, Indians worldwide. So everything that you said you're representing, now you're like the poster child for that. Are you kind of surprised by that reaction? And are you also afraid what that responsibility might hold?
I think my upbringing and every experience I've had in life has prepared me for this moment. And that sounds so cliche, but I didn't realize it until now. All these things when it comes to managing yourself and managing your own PR and how you are represented, I feel like I've got training, life training for that, of how to, because when you are a minority in Australia, whether you like it or not, you guys would also agree, being a Muslim Australian, you represent, you somehow have to just hold the shoulders of every Muslim in the world.
Well, and basically.
It's apparently you do, and no one really understands that, you know, you can't actually be an individual. You can't have, like, all these other passions or, you know, opinions on things. Now I have to have an opinion that, you know, allies with and lies within the certain grounds, or, you know, even now hanging out in the city, I will have to be careful. Not that I'm a raunchy girl, but, you know, like, I do have to worry about these things. And I feel like I already used to do that, but now it's just another layer of being, you know, in the public eye. But I'm also happy to do it. I think that, you know, one thing I've been emphasizing is it's not me that's a celebrity. It's not me that's a star. It's the message that is a celebrity. And that is a beautiful thing about spoken word. And I'm just lucky to be the body who got to carry it.
I think that was a very beautiful way to end your answer. Speaking of, you know, the message, let's talk about the means of the message. Let's talk about spoken word culture. So obviously, when you performed and you performed spoken word, I felt like because you did that, it was encouraging of the arts, and not just the arts, but diversity in the arts. Do you feel similarly?
Absolutely. I want everyone, you know, going back to your previous question about doubts, I was so scared to represent spoken word because I don't consider myself a legit, you know, written a book or, you know, toured the world with my poetry. That spoken word poetry and that, you know, art form is just a part of who I am, and it's just one facet. I feel like I've got all different parts to me. So I feel that it's really cool that I got to represent that and also open that world up to everyday Australians and everyday ethnic Australians who might, you know, feel, ethnic's a really weird word to use, but, you know, you get the point, you know, different people from different cultural backgrounds who might want to be the star in a ballet show, but, you know, can only be chosen if, you know, it was a particularly cultural ballet show. Now they can be like, hey, she was on mainstream TV. I can be in mainstream. Because sometimes change does not occur when we're in our incubated, safe, comfortable, left, you know, feminist, vegan environments. Like, I love that environment. I live in Brunswick. I'm very happy that I'm there. But we need to make change in mainstream society. That's where I think change can happen.
You talk about kind of being more than just a spoken word poet or things like, because I know you do a bit of theatre. Talking about the arts, talk to us about something that people might know about you, theatre.
Yeah, so my passions actually started, my dream was to become an actress and probably still is. I tried out for Whopper back in Perth a couple of times, and hopefully I'll try out for VCA this year in Victoria to get into the acting program. And then I, you know, fell into spoken word, and that's kind of taken over for a bit, but I haven't lost sight of the main goal, and that is to create diversity in film and in theatre.
Because, like, I know, like, you know, Johnny Ruffalo, whatever that guy's name, he was not that great of a singer. Went on X Factor, got into the final 12.
Johnny Ruffalo.
Really, he's not that great of a singer, but, you know, whatever. He got into the final 12 and finished X Factor, got on Home and Away, and now he's pretty much a staple on Home and Away. So that, you know, X Factor, top 12. Not X Factor. Australia's Got Talent, top 12. Get out. And then, hey, Neighbours, Home and Away. Here.
I don't know.
Just interjecting. I think Sukri could totally take X Factor as well.
You should just be my, like, agent. Just scout me to all
there are opportunities for everyone in this room.
Yeah, but I don't know if Neighbours and Home and Away is my cup of tea, just to put that out there.
Oh, like, but, I was watching the other day, and it is just so pasty white. Like,
it's very whitewashed.
The only
I saw
kind
an Indian
of,
once.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
She was wearing a sari.
Oh, but they killed, Neighbours killed,
killed
the Indian family out.
Oh, my God.
So they killed the mother.
Did they?
And then, yeah, they killed the mother, and then the family just, you know, had to leave for reasons unknown. And they have one, I know you're an avid Neighbours watcher. Nate is the only kind of
No way.
Non-white. I
would not have guessed that.
A lot of people say that. I don't know why everyone. It's because you're hipster. That's the exact same response you got a beard. By everyone. But I enjoy watching Neighbours.
You got a beard.
Anyway, oh, yeah. But I was going to ask you, because you obviously write, you know, you write poetry.
Yeah.
But I wanted to know what the process is for you to perform, because I feel like with spoken word poetry, there's a performance element to it. And what's that process like for you? So how do you like prepare to like perform a piece? Like,
yeah. So all my poetry is just like everyone would be based on personal experiences. And I found verbatim theatre in high school, and I don't know if you've heard of verbatim theatre, but it's basically word for word. Normally they're around cases, like, you know, the play I read was the Laramie Project, and it was about the brutal beating
right.
of two homosexual guys right. in Wyoming in America in the right. 80s and 90s, I think.
Yep.
So that play was word for word, all the different accounts of all the witnesses. So when I do my poetry, when someone has said something to me that is, you know, could be discriminatory or stuff that I've soaked up,
yeah.
Instead of, you know, chucking a fuss, I'll have my cry and my rant.
Right,
and then
right.
I'll be like, now I think I want to, how I heal and how I get over a situation
yeah.
is writing it down, but then taking it in the next step and actually performing it. Because right. as soon as I perform, I let go. Okay. And it turns into a comedy. It turns into a very detached experience. And I can say it again and again, still bring out a bit of emotion
yeah.
From like a bit of acting background, yeah. but also, also remember that, you know, just like every performer would say that your audience might, you know, even though I'll say that same poem a million times
yeah.
and a lot of audiences might have heard it a million times, but there will be that one person who's never heard it and they need to hear it exactly. Like it's a consistency thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And who are your, like, favourite poets or poets that inspire you personally?
I know everyone says this, but the first spoken word poet I stumbled upon was Sarah Kay. And
yeah.
she, it was that TED Talk, and I was like, oh, my God, this is perfect. This is what I want to do. So I, like, got obsessed with her. And it is probably because she's very popular as well, so there's a lot yeah. more available.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think in Melbourne, I'm really biased because I think I just love, not biased, I'm diplomatic because I love all, like, because you learn about the person and then you see them perform and you're like, oh, so much respect.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of respect for a lot of local artists too.
Right.
But I think when it comes to, there's a Sikh girl. Her name is Rupi Kaur and she's from Canada.
Yes.
And she is a great inspiration because, if you look at her Instagram posts and she does little drawings with her poetry and they're just so on point and she's not afraid and she's also got, you know, a really badass vibe to her. And I was at White Night last night and there was a tree outside the State Library and it had little quotes. I don't know who did it. I don't know what could have kind of linked, maybe it was linked to the library or something.
Right.
And it had a quote. I happened to be walking past, saw Rupi Kaur and I was like, hang on, who is one of her poems on a tree? I took a photo and sent it to her and I was like, holy moly, we're on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
And that is so beautiful to know.
It's a good feeling. Like one of my favorite poets is like Sharon Olds, for example. I don't know if you've, she's an American poet. Amazing. Check her work out.
Yeah.
She's amazing. And when I see like quotes from her or people at poetry readings who like recite her poems, it just like, it shivers, like I'm just, and it makes me feel more connected to, like, I guess poets or, you know,
yeah.
her work or whatever.
Oh, amazing.
You're talking about tokenism before. Are you kind of afraid that might happen to you? Are you afraid that, say, for example, now you've kind of, let's say, smashed the glass ceiling. Say after after Shows Got Talent, do you foresee, because like a lot of times you see people smash through the ceiling, but then they're more often than not they become tokenized and they're the token brown person, the token Muslim, the token Sikh in your case, to talk about all these issues. And sometimes you're not equipped to talk about those issues. Sometimes you don't want to always be talking about those issues. Is that a fear of yours?
Of course. I think that would have been a decision or choice I had to make at a very young age when I started putting my putting myself out there for a lot of leadership positions back in Perth, whether it came to high school or the community, especially in the Sikh community. I was the token Sikh girl that would be emceeing at all the events or would be going to represent Sikh youth in different conferences and all that. So I think I'm used to it. But the reason I moved to Melbourne was because I didn't want to be the daughter of someone, the son, the sister of someone, the family member of someone, or that Sikh girl. I wanted to be Sukhjeet, and I wanted to express myself and learn who I was without all that. And now that I've had that, it's only been 11 months, but I feel like I've had that grounding and time to explore and just be like ultimately free, that I'm kind of learning how I've got, like, if I wanted to talk about a certain issue, for example, if I want to talk about sexuality, I can't talk about that right now. But if I have a 10-step plan of how I could get there in the near future and be able to talk about that as a Sikh girl, that would be amazing. But you have to first, gain the trust of your community, gain the trust of your fans. And so right now I'm currently at a very safe, I'm at a very safe point where I hope, you know, if, for example, if you were talking along the lines of, you know, tokenism or someone going, we need an Indian for this. Unfortunately, there is like two sides to the coin. One side is, yeah, you can't escape the fact that your skin color is a certain color. Can't help it. If you want to get plastic surgery, go ahead. But right now, I've got brown skin. I've got hairy armpits. So, yeah, I will be categorized in a certain spot. But how I use that and actually learn how to use that to the, you know, to my advantage, that would be pretty cool. So yeah, I might get boxed in a lot of things, but I'm learning how to be picky with a lot of opportunities that come my way. And I can, I'm very thankful that, you know, I've been given an upbringing that, you know, that you do get an intuition of like, what is dodgy, what's worth it, what's not, when are people using you? And when are you being used? Like, I understand that with Australia's Got Talent, yeah, it's probably, unplaced there. A lot of people might say, a lot of reviewers might say, oh, you look at her, she's just a token brown person they got to make everyone feel good, or, you know, she's got a story or blah, blah, blah. But that's good for them. But I know I've got my own agenda, and I think I could wash my hands right now and walk away from the competition and be so satisfied with what has happened, because that type of Sikh PR is not happened in history when it comes to being able to just talk about who Sikhs are, especially after 9/11. It's just been so hard. You could spend millions and billions of dollars on PR and advertising and NGOs and all that, but to get up there and be handed those 2 minutes for free, of course I'm going to grab that opportunity.
Also, what I want to talk to about is, you know, you performed before Missy Higgins. How was that?
It was funny because people think, because the event was planned way before Australia's Got Talent stuff started. She saw me perform at Walk Together, which was the, I don't know if you guys have heard of Welcome to Australia. So at the Walk, we ended up at Fed Square in Melbourne, and I did the Advanced Australia Fair poem, and there was Claire Bowditch, who did some songs. Jamila Rivesby, who was the editor of Mamma Mia, was there. A couple of MPs and like a Green Senator or something. And I did the poem. I got off stage, and I'm the biggest fan of Missy Higgins. Like, oh my God, just love, love, love her. And there's something about like Aussie artists that have like an accent when they sing. Is just like, even Aussie hip hop, I'm like obsessed with Aussie hip hop because of the accent, and I just love it and I prefer it. So seeing her, and she, I was like, star, what is that when you're like, ah, oh, flustered, starstruck, absolutely starstruck. I did not have words to talk, and she was just like, oh, hey, yeah, you know, we should hang out because my husband's into spoken word, and he used to do spoken word back in the day, and I'd love for you to meet him. And I was like, oh. And then she finds me on Twitter, and she goes, hey, I found you. Would love, you know, you to perform at my event, and I fainted, and I like could not believe that it was happening. And then obviously like Australia's Got Talent stuff was happening, so I was busy with that. And then I rock up to the gig on Wednesday, and I've been so busy that it didn't hit me that this was happening. And I'm on the side stage, and I'm about to go on, and I do my thing, and it feels amazing. And then you walk off, and then Missy's on doing her thing, and I'm just sitting there watching the concert from side stage and just crying, like absolutely bawling my eyes out at how special that feeling was to, you know that it's so possible to get to achieve what you want. I don't have, you know, ties in the music industry in my family. My family is not, you know, from some acting, performing, artsy family. And it's just hard when you're, you know, trying to break that scene and break those barriers and trying to get through. It's definitely who you know, but it's so special to know that people out there like Missy Higgins can recognize something and believe in you. And it's an honor, seriously an honor.
So, like, there's something that reminds me. I find a lot of parallels. Sorry, I'm a little bit incoherent. I find parallels with Ashley Calling Bull, who won Mrs. Universe last year, and she's an Indigenous Canadian woman. And the next day, as soon as she won that title, she started posting in support of the rights and the conditions and the issues that concern the First Nations people of Canada. And she got a lot of backlash. Mm. And she responded, you know, like, what did you think? You know, did you not think I was going to use this platform and talk about what I believe in? You think I'm just a pretty face? And so I guess in a similar way, did you get any backlash for your performance?
My housemate, I love that example, by the way, that's beautiful. My housemate has forbid me from reading comments, and Missy Higgins told me never to read comments. So I actually, for the first time, took their advice and haven't read comments, but what I have read is my messages. So I have been getting, you know, in your Facebook and your Twitter and all your different, you know, ways, and email as well, because my email is public for inquiries. And I have been reading them in your little message request and filtered section. So you do get a lot of trolls. And yesterday I actually posted a photo of one of them because, you know, I've been screenshotting them, not replying because I don't want to give in and actually give attention because that's what a lot of people want. So I'll block them, report them, and then screenshot them and keep them in a folder called hate because I really want to use that one day and create something from it. But yeah, so one guy, he's just like, oh, you're a cancer to South Asians. You know, why don't you just shave your hairy armpits? You're so unhygienic. You're lowering the standards of the Indian community. His name, it said Adam Lopez. I doubt it was an Adam Lopez. It had like a, I don't know, probably just made up a name. And then, you know, a lot of swearing and just random stuff. I think it's just people can't handle, first of all, that you're talking about something. It's so confronting, but also the fact that you're a feminist. And, you know, my cover photo on purpose, I haven't changed it. It's got my hairy armpits out there. And I do that consciously to say that if you love me, you got to love all of me, like, because I love all of me. So if you want some, you can't just like have a part of it and just pick and choose what you like. But it's interesting when you look at your, you know, Facebook pages, you can look at the insights section and see what demographic is actually liking and communicating on your page. And I've actually found it's actually men aged between 25 and 35. That's my demographic. I didn't even know that was my demographic. I've got marriage proposals. I've got lots of people saying they love me and they just wanted me to be their life partner. Just one little favor. And I'm just like, wow. There you go. So I think what will be really interesting is when my next performance is what, because I know what it is. I can't share what it is, but you can probably gauge it's a little bit more controversial and it's going to open up another chapter of me.
I think I've seen it, maybe.
Yeah, I think I have too.
I think I've seen it and I'm really excited for it.
Yeah.
But I think we're going to have to say goodbye.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on the show. Bye. Really appreciate it. And everyone, please, you know, support Sukhjit. Find her on Facebook, Twitter and all that kind of stuff. Watch her on Channel 9.
Channel 9.
Channel 9 on Australia's Got talent. If you want to see her advance, because voting, isn't it?
Yes, there'll be a voting. Yep.
There'll be a voting. I'm going to vote for you.
Oh, I've got you, man.
No worries. We're all going to vote for you. Racecard publicly endorses Sukjit for Australia's Got Talent. All right, so if you're listening, you do the same. Again, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Tony Abbott was really never a deeply popular figure among the electorate.
Yes. Tony Abbott faced some hostility of his own.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Oh, really?
And really the reason why his prime ministership has crumbled is because he lost the support of the electorate and ultimately the governing Liberal Party.
This is not an easy day for many people in this building. Leadership changes are never easy for our country.
The Prime Minister's not going to lose, he's going to win.
My pledge today is to make this change as easy as I can.
Goodbye, Tony. Bye-bye. Goodbye, Tony. Tony, time to go. Goodbye, roll over. Knock him talking
to the bed. Bye-bye, Tony. Now we're going into our segment, The Week That Was, where we highlight some of the most notable or infamous stories from the past week.
So, this is very exciting news. Clever Man, a new TV show with an 80% Indigenous cast, becomes the first Australian show to premiere at Berlin International Film Festival, also known as Berlinale, and also it's one of the leading film festivals in the world. So the TV show is set in the near future. A breed from ancient mythology are forced to live with the inhabitants of the earth, humans, and fight to survive against the silence and exploitation of humans as they seek to destroy them. Now, at the centre of this story are two estranged brothers, Cohen and Waru West, who are forced together to battle against terrifying enemies, both human and not of this world. One of the producers, Rosemary Blight, recalls there being a lot of questions regarding the writing room. So she said the team, two Indigenous writers and two non-Indigenous writers, had to find a way to take the stories into the future and be entertaining, because this was an anthology. This was not an anthology. It's a drama, she says. It's like knitting. It was so complicated. It was certainly the hardest thing I've ever been involved with. But the difficulties pushed the creativity, made everything more deep. Now, I just want to give a quick shout out to one of the actresses, Deborah Mailman. She is an Australian television and film actress. She was the first Aboriginal actress to win the Australian Film Institute Award for Best Actress in Leading Role. She is well known for having played the character Kelly on successful Australian television series The Secret Life of Us. Do you guys watch that back in the day?
No, but I do remember her from play school, and she was one of my childhood heroes.
She's awesome.
I'd just like to say that. And, you know, I'm really excited for this show, because we've been talking a long time about television in Australia being so bloody white, and how there isn't enough diversity on television. Now we have a 80% Indigenous cast in this show about an Indigenous superhero, and that is so cool.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's amazing.
And this is not even just like, this is not like this isn't a small show. This is humongous. It's being backed by a lot of people.
Yes.
You know?
It's amazing because it's very, like, it's sci-fi. So, like, they're portraying normal people, normal characters, and it's not about,
it's just about them being people, right?
Exactly.
That's the thing.
Exactly. And I feel that that's so refreshing to me, to see or to hear, because usually it's about, well, any minority, usually it's about them being a minority. But anyways, I like the fact that they're just being sci-fi characters,
yeah,
if that
just,
makes sense.
Yeah, they're just people who happen to be Indigenous on this show. And, yes. it's really cool because, like, and also we've been talking about how you might have a diverse cast, but you also just have a very kind of white writing room. And
yes.
that isn't the case here. You have two Indigenous. So out of the four writers, two of them are Indigenous, two of them are non-Indigenous.
Yeah.
And that's really encouraging. And I'm personally very excited for this show, and I think it's going to be...
Some way.
Yeah, it's going to... Because I think there are a lot of really notable people working on the show. I think people who've worked on The Hunger Games, people that's worked on Game of Thrones, a lot of people... Like, this is going to be... I think Sundance TV are a part of this as well. So this is going to be like a humongous television series. It's going to be 6 episodes, 1 hour each episode. And yeah, it's really exciting.
So I'm just assuming that when we talk about the breed from ancient mythology, it's... I don't know, this sounds very weird to say, but it's basically not fiction, right? Like, it's an actual ancient mythology?
I think it's fiction.
It's all purely fiction.
Yeah, it's purely fiction.
Well, what I was going to say anyway was that I think it's a great creative and artistic expression just to have that, you know, that diversity, not just, you know, the characters in the writing room or whatever, but the storyline. The storyline is great. It sounds very exciting.
It is.
We have any idea, like, what time, like, when can we expect
Shouldn't it be out, like, mid 2016, maybe, like, June, July? But there's going to be a screening, like Morgan said, in... Where was it?
Berlin.
And that's very soon. But, like, we were watching a trailer earlier of the show, and it seemed really interesting. And there's, like... I'm very, very excited for this, because we don't usually get, like, shows that are... Like, there aren't very many superhero shows that are based in Australia at all. Mm-hmm. And for the first one to be about Indigenous superheroes is pretty awesome.
Yeah. I'm not a massive sci-fi fan, but...
I am.
But the fact that they're playing... I mean, the main characters are Indigenous, right? But it's sci-fi. It's not like...
Yeah, it's not about them. It's about them. Exactly.
Same as like Benjamin Law's TV show.
Yeah, the family
right?
law.
They're
right.
just,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. They're just, it's just a family, right?
Yeah. And they just happen to be Chinese Australians.
Exactly.
And then I guess the thing is, right, that we normalize these ideas of people just being people instead of being kind of like, the story is them being migrants, being refugees, being... racialized, being kind of like being all these negative attributes being the story opposed to them just being people.
Yeah, and just, you know, on that topic, I think it's very interesting because when we usually talk about Indigenous people or when we think about them, we posit them with the past, you know, at best the present. So I think to translate that into the, you know, fictional world, but as well as the future, I think that's pretty transgressive. I think that's very exciting.
Put more beautiful people of colour on TV and connect viewers in ways which transcend race and unite us. That's the real Team Australia.
You know, you look at the American TV, British TV, it, you know, has, you know, it's got shows with different nationalities. And not just putting nationalities just for the point of difference, but creating work that caters for actors of different backgrounds.
In my mind, I see a line. And over that line, I see green fields and lovely flowers. And beautiful white women with their arms stretched out to me over that line. But I can't seem to get there no how. I can't seem to get over that line. That was Harriet Tubman in the 1800s. And let me tell you something. The only thing that separates women of color from anyone else is opportunity. You cannot win an Emmy for roles that are simply not there.
Early this week, an Indigenous politician, Bess Nungara, Price was told she couldn't speak her language in Parliament. A few months back, Mrs. Price said that it wasn't the words that troubled her, but the language they were spoken in. However, NT Speaker Kayser Purick said, "For the transaction of everyday business, the language of Assembly is English. On that basis, should a member use a language other than English without the leave of the Assembly, it will be ruled disorderly and the member will be required to withdraw the words." They also cited that it would be complex and costly to have Indigenous languages incorporated into Parliament. And right now we've got BuzzFeed's Indigenous Affairs reporter, Alan Clark, on the line. Hi, Alan. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why is it so complex and costly for Indigenous politicians like Mrs. Price to speak her own language in Parliament?
Well, I think the real issue here is that, well, there's a sort of standing orders of the NT Parliament and every subsequent Parliament around the country say that the official language of the House or, you know, within Parliament is English. So I think that's the issue. This happened last year during a heated debate about education, and Bess felt like she wasn't getting a word in, so she said something in Walpuri, which is her traditional language, and then that was objected to by several Labor MPs, who then basically said that, you know, she should be speaking English so they understand. This speaker agreed with them, because it is in the standing orders. So that incident happened last December. And then earlier this year, Bess wrote a letter contesting that and said that she should be able to speak her traditional language in Parliament. And the Speaker wrote to her again and said, well, the only way to have this change is to actually change the standing orders in the Parliament. So that's the real issue, but obviously a lot of Indigenous people are upset, saying that, you know, we should have a right to speak our languages in Parliament. Bess was advocating for to be able to speak her language and then immediately have it translated into English so that people in the Legislative Assembly in the Northern Territory would be able to then understand what she was saying. So I think that's the issue in a nutshell, but essentially the standing orders remain that, you know, English is the language of the House. Maybe that's time for a discussion. Maybe this will bring about discussion into whether, you know, Bess might challenge those standing orders, and that could potentially set a precedent.
Also, because it's obviously, you know, this is traditional owners of land's language, obviously, and, like, you would think to incorporate more Indigenous people into Parliament and to make that a viable option, you'd create something like this to incorporate language to make people feel it is an accessible area for them to, an accessible venture for them to enter.
Yeah, and I suppose the argument is that, well, does the Parliament accommodate for Indigenous people whose second language is English, perhaps, particularly in a place like the Northern Territory? Or Western Australia, even, where, you know, English is you know, often a second or third language for many Aboriginal communities. So for them to actually come into Parliament and utilise English, maybe they wouldn't be able to do that to their best ability. So maybe there is scope there to look into, well, if we want to encourage more people from remote or kind of traditional communities to get involved in politics, maybe we do need to look at having, say, translators or interpreters actually in the Parliament. There are some countries that do have that. I know in Canada there are bilingual in terms of French and English, and they have translations from time to time. So it's not impossible, but as you say there, it's a very good point. How are we going to encourage people who maybe English is a third or fourth language to get into politics, which is so heavily rooted in a English kind of English system?
And also because we've seen in other countries, I'm pretty sure New Zealand have a more accommodating aspect to the Maori people, the Indigenous people over there, in terms of how they can enter Parliament. Is that something lacking in Australia?
Well, I think it's very different. I mean, when you're talking New Zealand, you're talking about also a school system that, you know, teaches Maori to everyone from a very young age. People are very engaged with Maori culture from a very young age. Everybody feels like they, you know, they're part of the history of New Zealand. I guess when you look at Australia, it's very different. We don't do that. We don't learn Aboriginal languages. But I think there's appetite. The Prime Minister, you know, when he delivered the Closing the Report, Closing the Gap report last week, opened his address in Ngunnawal, which is the traditional language of Canberra, and it was largely applauded by, you know, Aboriginal leaders and community members. So I think it's a, you know, there is appetite, and it could be the way of the future if everybody got behind it. But at the same time, Maori, there is a common language. There are in Australia, you know, there are hundreds of Aboriginal languages. So maybe we'd have to decide on a common one for the Parliament to be introduced.
I'm banning all rap this year at the awards. Yeah, don't get me wrong, I love hip hop, obviously. But tonight, it's all about soul. Okay, hold on a second. I got another call. Wait a minute. What's up, Young Thug? No, honestly, man, you are my favorite artist out right now. But I ain't letting anybody in with no littles and youngs and their name. Yeah. Hang on one second. I'm sorry, y'all. Yes. Who is this? Iggy Azalea. Yeah, hey. Oh, no, you can come, because what you're doing is definitely not rap. Yeah. Yeah, I got on my overalls. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to send an Uber for you right now. Yeah, come on, be outside.
We've spoken about the High Court ruling a few weeks ago, but in the past couple of days, the attempts of the return of Baby Asha to Nauru have been, you know, quite substantial after she had serious burns that made her go to the hospital in Queensland, and a lot of people were worried about her and whether she'd be sent back. And over the weekend, activists and doctors alike joined forces in preventing her release from the Lady Celentano Children's Hospital in Brisbane. You know, but the thing that worries me is that after this ordeal that she had being burnt very substantially in Nauru, the thought was, hey, she'll get recovered and then we're going to send her back to Nauru, right? And like, what was very kind of troubling was it took protesters barricading themselves in the roads that lead into the hospital, that took them making sure that no vehicles could leave the hospital for them to make a scene for Peter Dutton to think, hey, maybe we shouldn't send a one-year-old baby to a detention centre. And what was extremely worrying was an advocate of the family, Natasha Blocher, told the media a few days ago, talking about the mother. She said she told me she didn't know where she would be going, she being Asha, going, because they wouldn't tell her. I think that's quite scary for somebody with a little baby to know that people who have power to take you somewhere and that you have no right to know where that is. And that's extremely scary. Can you imagine being a mother in that situation and not having control of where your child may go? Thankfully, you know, like, even saying thankfully this, it's a stretch. They decided they'll be in community detention in Australia, and that the parent, the mother and daughter will be together. That's great, but the fact that they're still in detention is a huge issue, isn't it?
I mean, I think speaking to that, I think it's very telling, but at the same time, it's concerning that you could send a baby or a child or anyone back to the place of abuse. I mean, that is not the kind of protocol you would have. And that is something that disproportionately, it seems, to affect undocumented people, or not just undocumented people, but this use of legality in order to preface humanity.
Because, like, let's just we look at the history books. Legality has never been any kind of scope for morality. It's never been a kind of like, all right, so just because something is legalized doesn't mean it's good. And I feel like we've got to get over this idea that because something's written in law, that means the moral bastions of the lawmakers know what's right for humans at large. And we just look at Australia's history, and it's clearly not been the case.
Right. But as well as, you know, when we talk about child services, sorry, in a more Australian context, I think you wouldn't necessarily send a child back, do you know what I mean, back to an area of abuse. So even in terms of legality, even if you do look at it in that sense, that protocol does not make sense. Or does it get limited to documentation?
Yeah, exactly. And who has the right to be taken care of and have a safe haven in that sense? Because, say, for example, a child was being abused in a family setting, that child would be immediately taken and looked after and would be made sure not to be in that setting again. But this child who's being put in detention, even the idea of putting children in detention is disgusting. Putting this child already, this one-year-old child, can you imagine? And probably by that time, she was probably like a couple of months, not necessarily one, because he's been going for some time. A one-year-old child, maybe less than, in a detention center, and then that being, like, there's so many things that could happen. There's so many abuse that could be happen. There's so many horrible things that leaves scope for that being there, and it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah, and that just reminds me back to, was it the John Howard days, when he started this PR idea of asylum seekers were basically throwing their children overseas or something like that, like over the boat or something, as a means to justify this is why we can't let these kind of values come into our country or whatever it is. And it's like, well, it looks like your values aren't that different. You're just throwing people back, you know, throwing babies back into areas of abuse. You're actually not caring for them either. Even, I mean, obviously, that's not to say that his PR agenda was true. I'm just saying, if you suppose it is true, it's not that you're any different. As a matter of fact, I actually think he's worse. I mean, reality is people are not throwing their children, you know, out of boats. But
like, even about that, like, I have a friend who was actually, two friends whose family was on a boat that was featured in a documentary a few years ago about that moment when he said that. And they thankfully came to Australia, and now three of them, one's at least a university graduate, two of them are in university, and they're making their way, and they're obviously contributing to society. And this myth, right, that refugees who come to Australia don't contribute to society is obviously a fallacy, because these three people are now going to a workplace or workforce, whatever, and contribute, pay taxes or what have you, and has made Australia as a country more beneficial. You know, it's, they've given back so much, and this idea that refugees are lazy and all that kind of jazz is, as I said, just like a fallacy.
And just riding on that last point, I mean, do we need to wait for them to be successful in a capitalist, in a, you know, productive, the way how we imagine productive sense, you know? So does that justify the conditions, you know, the conditionality of accepting people? You know, I feel like, you know, I think it comes from a good place. Like, I understand why there are campaigns of, you know, this person used to be like a refugee and now they're a surgeon and they're doing great things. And I think that's great. I'm not trying to discount any of that. I'm just wary that there are different, you know, intersections with that kind of argument. And that's not to discredit to the asylum seekers and refugees who do come to Australia, of course.
No, but this is the thing, like, people that come here are just people, right? And there are people that will go to university. There are people that will have struggles in life. There are people that will find means elsewhere. And the idea is that they're just like anybody else, and not to differentiate them from the regular Joe Blow or anyone on the street, right?
I'm Luke from Indigenous X, and you're listening to The Race Card.
So moving on, for those of us in social justice circles, anti-racism is a term many of us are familiar with, particularly amongst educators and those of us in tertiary education systems. And while it is understandable, perhaps even arguably necessary for the rise and continuity of critical race studies in academia, from establishing legitimate, in quotation marks, legitimate research, as well as documenting and learning from each other and thinkers, the risk of inaccessibility becomes ever more pertinent. And by relying on academic jargon to carry through our anxieties and compensate for our actions or inactions, anti-racism becomes stifled. It is not that anti-racism has no place in the education system or in academia at large, but rather it deserves to permeate beyond that. One can be anti-racist and anti-oppression more broadly without having to be an academic, for instance, or use academic language. And after all, by closing off or undernourishing the many ways anti-racism, activism, and education can take place, we risk limiting such impact and conversations within the academic sector, effectively operating through exclusion. Because, you know, long story short, not everyone's gonna go through tertiary education, and they don't have to. However, we have witnessed more unconventional yet effective means of anti-racism work. Education en masse is part of that. Last night marked the third year of Melbourne's White Night festivities. Melbourne Spoken Word had an artist lineup from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., and while not necessarily an act of resistance and subversion in and of itself, it provided the platform for several spoken word artists to speak their truth and identity, belonging, and discrimination on public stage. Melbourne Museum and the Bunjilaka Aboriginal Cultural Centre presented Woman Jeka, Black Knight, which opened the doors of the First Peoples exhibition from sundown to sunrise to an audience of several thousands to educate themselves on the living cultures of Victoria's Koori people. And complementing that, there were spectacular projections on the Royal Exhibition Building and Millari Gardens with lights and sounds brought to life with the Open Your Eyes show by Picture-Making Fellas and Okobu with the Electric Canvas, whose storyline enthralled audiences as it spoke of Indigenous knowledge of seasons. And of course, we have Benjamin Law's The Family Law TV series being picked up by a major television broadcasting group. And while none of these are directly or explicitly anti-racist, its subversion comes through its accessibility and material existence. What are your thoughts on that?
Like I agree, like this idea that anti-racism dialogue can only happen through academics and people who have this kind of like this, the language, so to speak, is it's also very classist when people think about it. Like, not everyone can go to university, not everyone can actually go to these classes. People find other ways to talk about race. You don't necessarily need to talk, like, even that example of Benjamin Law, right? He doesn't necessarily explicitly talk about race. They talk about, the way they talk about race is through subtleties. And I was talking to Muggan beforehand, and he was saying, like, the way that he was navigating his identity throughout that show was through subtleties. And there was little subtle kind of discussions that happen. There's little things that they do. And the idea is that to kind of, like, normalize these things, right? To kind of, like, have one way of anti-racist work is to normalize seeing people that you don't normally see. So seeing that what you saw last night, the Black Knight, that was normalizing seeing Indigenous art and making that very accessible. Seeing Benjamin Law's show on SBS, that's making it more accessible, even though he wrote a book, but not everyone knew about that book, right? And all these kinds of things, because I feel like we have to kind of like diversify the way we even see anti-racist work, because all the time we're quoting these great academics, and they are so crucial, but ideas need to filter down, and for them to filter down, you need them to be put into public culture. So you need podcasts like us, you know, subscribe to Risk. you need shows, you need articles that talk in like lay language, you know what I mean? The everyday person can understand. So, and also, like, what I always wonder is, why does academia have to be so wordy?
Everyone can play a part in this. So academics obviously have their part, and very important, because they've, you know, studied many years in, like, race theory, for example. But, like, I think artists, like, for example, Amir Rahman's video on reverse racism, like,
it blew up.
It blew up, and it's very accessible. People could easily understand what he was saying. And so I feel, well, one of the reasons, well, I don't know, one of the reasons of doing anti-racist work, I feel anyway, is to make people of colour human. That's what essentially what we're fighting for, or we're saying, right? So what's a way, what's some ways of humanising someone? Like, you tell a personal story about that person, about that group or whoever. Like, to go back to Benjamin Law's TV show, the main character, Benjamin, you could see that he was, you know, awkward and was into, like, acting and his relationship with his siblings. And, you know, it's very relatable to every person. It's actually universal, you know, family relationships, dysfunctional families, his mother, who was awesome. Yeah, so I feel like we can all play a part in that. Because we all know, on one level, you know, these stories, like, relationship between mother and daughter or mother and father is universal, but there's a group of people who maybe the world doesn't see as human. And through, I think, subtleties like that, it can be shown so easily. Like, all you need to do to show, I'll take, use myself as an example. If someone was going to write about me, for example, it could just show simple things like, I like Neighbours, for example, or I love fruit and I love dancing. And, you know, I the school that I went to first was blah, blah there. And I had my first memory there, or I had my first dance there, or whatever. And that's automatically, like, humanizing me, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And so this whole thing reminded me of a movie I watched like 10 years ago. Has any of you watched Head of State?
Head of State, is that Chris Rock?
Yeah, Chris Rock and Bernie Mac, the late Bernie Mac.
No, yeah.
So basically, Chris Rock is running to be president. And I think there was a question about policy. And he basically says something to the effect of, if you want to have people understand policy changes or encourage policy change or whatever, put it in a music video. And, you know, I watched this like 10 years ago. And very honestly, like, even at the time, I was not conscious at all. Like, I had no, like, recollection of any of these things. Sorry, not recollection, but I had no, like, understanding, like, academic understanding of oppression. But it hit me. I was like, yeah, that's true. Because, you know what? People are not following our conversations in Parliament, you know? Like, teenagers are probably not doing that. Not en masse, at least. You know, people at university, probably not either. Like, as much as we like to think that they're academic or they're, you know, in that type of field. But when you have, even with, like, Suu Kyi, even going on Australia's Got Talent, you know, family law, we're talking about that. White Knight last night was pretty on that as well. And I think it's great. And I like seeing that, you know, like Beyonce when she had feminist written behind her.
Right.
I think that's all great examples of how we can make this accessible, because the truth is, you know, a book is so lengthy. A course is 3 years.
Yeah.
And not everyone's going to have the time, resources or anything to go through those things. And everyone kind of deserves to have a piece of the message.
Yeah, like we talked about Beyonce's video last week and how SNL did like a skit about how white people reacted to it. And that in its own right is a clever way of showing kind of like white fragility without any of that jargon, right?
Yeah.
So you're showing how people react to Beyonce doing the smallest thing that kind of incorporate her blackness. Like, oh, I didn't expect it to be the reaction to be that strong. And that video kind of like put it in a nutshell, like people were like, oh my God, she's black, right? and that thing, like, and we're talking about seeing people as humans, and it, And that became, oh, she's black, that means she's weird. You know what I mean? So that kind of thing. So I totally agree. And this idea that we have to have things in kind of like 13,000 word theses and what have you is ridiculous. Why do people need to, like, that needs to be there, but that is not the be-all, the end-all. And I feel like that has become the be-all and end-all in all of race kind of discussions. And
right. And just going back in academia and talking about discussion, you know, I think we also have to be mindful that a lot of this is in English, in academic English, not just any kind of academic, you know, language. So, for example, one of the very eye-opening things I've done in the past is being editor of my university magazine, but that in itself was not the, you know, that was not it. When I started writing on anti-racism for that student publication, I would take home these print copies. My parents would read them. My parents are Filipino and Sri Lankan. They are very high-functioning individuals, but they don't have the same command of English as I do. Of course, we can communicate and stuff on an everyday, daily basis. But when they would read my articles and they would come to me and say, Amina, could you translate this paragraph for me? Like, I actually don't understand what this means. And it's very telling when people who are affected by racism in this instance cannot understand what you're writing. And, you know, I think I fall into that trap where I do use academic language. I do write quite academically, but it kind of started, I guess, a reason for me to rethink my ways of doing things and maybe write a little bit more accessibly. And with that, that's our show for this week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Don't forget to podcast it if you just tuned in, and if you want to hear the rest of the show, you can follow the show on Twitter at The Race Card, and our co-hosts.
Me, Ahmed Yusuf, you can follow me at Ahmed Yusuf 10, and I'm pretty sure Muggan has places you can find him as well.
Yeah, on Twitter, the handle MugganMuggan9.
Yeah.
I don't think only Twitter.
SoundCloud as well. It's UgganMuggan. But you can, if you go to my Twitter, you have all the...
That's a central page, basically. But also, you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/racecardshow. You can find us on Tumblr, racecardpodcast.tumblr.com. You can find us on the interwebs, racecardpodcast.com. And please, you know, rate and review us on iTunes. Help us jump those iTunes charts and, you know, help the show out. All right, that's me saying goodbye for this week.
And thank you for listening, as always.
See ya.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.